Good day, everyone. Welcome to the CSU Relentless Gardener podcast. I am Colorado State University horticultural specialist Linda Langelo, and joining me today is Melissa Schreiner, entomologist of Colorado State University Extension in the Tri-River area. Now let's get to the heart of it, where we explore the topic of insect pest update from Western Colorado. Hello, Melissa. How are you?
I'm great, Linda. Thanks for having me again on the Relentless Gardener podcast. Happy to be here today.
Oh, always a pleasure. Always a pleasure. So tell the listening audience, you as an entomologist, what is your daily routine like?
You know, an extension entomologist's life is not boring. I feel I've gotten to know a group of extension entomologists nationally, and every day is different. So we could be giving an insect program at a library, giving adult learners an opportunity to learn about insects, or we could be working with farmers to solve on-farm issues relating to insect pests. I could be called by a hospital, a brewery, the school district, a worried parent. Every day is very different and therefore never boring for that reason. We could be doing on-farm research to help to answer a question that's happening in the community. I could be getting a call from a county commissioner about an issue, supporting staff across the western side of the state on insect-related identifications and issues that come into our extension offices across the state. So I like that I wear many hats, and it definitely keeps it interesting.
Well, it's no different with a extension horticulturalist. You know, you never know what's going to walk in the door. It's kind of like a doctor. And some you have appointments with and you kind of know, and some just come out of the blue, or you go to a location and somebody says, "Oh, can you talk to my neighbor? They've got this tree issue." And you're like, "Sure, whatever." And off you go.
I know. Being a diagnostician is it's unpredictable, and it helps to have skills in a lot of areas, and it continues to build those skills working in all those areas.
And you know, people, I don't think know this, but it's as challenging as medicine. You know, it's like things can have the similar symptoms, but be something very different and mimic. And even insects can mimic. You
Yes.
know, one another, which is really smart on the natural world's part. But for humans, it's like, okay, how can I keep up with this?
I know insect camouflage and aposematism. So, an animal's ability to blend in or to stand out, to serve some function of survival it's a big part of the animal kingdom. It extends beyond insects. But I always tell folks that they can't love animals. They say they love animals and they say they don't love insects. Well, invertebrates make up 70% of the animal kingdom here, folks. So we've got to be inclusive of, you know, everybody represented there. A lot of them are insects. So,
yeah. And hey, they keep ecosystems going, you know?
They do. They're driving important cycles. I'm famous for saying you would not want to live on a planet with dead bodies and feces everywhere that didn't go away. We need our decomposers. You wouldn't want to live on a planet without a lot of our edible plants that come from pollination.
Exactly.
Insects are driving a lot of important things for ecology worldwide.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
And there's an important thing that a lot of farmers use, as well as greenhouses, as well as nurseries, and it's called integrated pest management. Can you explain to people what that is and why it's so important?
Yes, of course, Linda. It's a historical concept. So pest management, or pest control in general, is where that word originally came from. And then integrated was added into the word. It's really the approach. It's first cultural controls. What can we do to manipulate our environment to change a pest being present? Or maybe a physical barrier, using something like row cloth or nets to exclude pests. So something physical. And then maybe lastly, making a decision to use a tool like an insecticide or a pesticide more broadly to solve a problem. But it's the approach to problem solving. And it comes down to how we manipulate either our decisions or our environment or what tools we use to solve pest-related issues. So whether we are battling rodents or caterpillars in corn or domestic beetles in bird seed, you name it, whether it's a stored product pest or a pest in a restaurant or on a farm, we have an approach to scientifically and sustainably handle that problem. And there's only so many tools in our toolbox, so on some problems we are limited on what's available in terms of that problem solving. But there's always a certain approach with
Right.
integrated pest management.
Well, and you think about let's do something when it gets to a certain threshold. And customers and clients, they don't always want to hear that. You know, they see a pest and they want something that's sort of a panacea that's going to work, and they want that's it and they're done and they
They want a
want to
silver bullet. They sure
yeah.
do.
Well,
Yeah.
there are rarely, if at all, any silver bullets.
Yes. I agree. More complex biology is more complex than that, is what I think it comes down to.
Oh, absolutely. So, is that part of one of the biggest challenges that you face in the region with growers?
So, in terms of, pest management, yes. I mean, I would say through my lens, I'd say some of the biggest issues that we face are related, yeah, to insects and their management. And it's hard to catch it in time. I mean, research is behind when we are often reacting to some of these issues that blow up into agricultural communities. Colorado is a massive state with massive counties, and we've got pockets of horticultural production everywhere in the state that you look, and everyone has something to battle in those systems. And yeah, at least through my lens, insects and them as pests are some of, yeah, the worst challenges I see out here in ag.
Well, and to think about all the varied regions and ecosystems that are varied across the state, there's so many nuances to each one. And until you're there to see it and learn about it, you won't know how to solve it. And a lot of issues are, at least some of them with horticulture, like maintaining plants, is about cultural practices. Oh, well, I think you need to water this more or water it less. In agriculture, that even gets to be even more difficult.
Yeah, it definitely does. Whether you have chemical coming from a spray plane, or you have, I mean, there's a lot of variables involved with taking care of pests so that our food can be perfectly presentable to distributors and end up in grocery stores. And yeah, there's a lot of angles of trying to keep our food free of the insect pests that threaten our food security. I mean, really, truly, pests broadly, so diseases, insects. That whole encompassing group is our number one threat to global food security. I
Right.
would say number one.
Yeah. I was listening to this podcast yesterday, and it was it's from oh, it's from Kansas anyway. And they were talking about raccoons and field corn and how you have to be careful, especially homeowners if they're growing corn, they can attract a lot of raccoons, and before they even get to harvest the corn, the raccoons have taken one bite and destroyed the corn.
Yep.
And so you have to wait, 3 weeks before and watch it tassel just slightly, and it tassels green and all this stuff. And it's like you don't think about, when you're a farmer, how much can invade that aren't necessarily insects, but wildlife that come in and just can devastate percentages of your crop. So
Voles and rabbits. When I was a vegetable producer in northern Colorado, I couldn't believe the beds that we had thought ahead of time about keeping those wild animals out of. Those did the best because we had pig fence and we put additional barriers up to keep pests out, but certain beds didn't have that infrastructure and just got my lettuce beds would just be happily devoured by rabbits each year, each spring and fall when I was a vegetable producer. And yeah, it all goes into how much in advance have you thought about preventing some of this behavior that we see from from
Right.
animals, wildlife, insect pests, you
Right.
name it.
Right. Or just expect it's part of the territory,
Yes.
and you're gonna plan extra, and you're gonna say, okay, now you can't direct them towards that, but know that you're gonna lose a percentage, which is
Yep.
not helpful, but anyway.
It's the way it works out in the garden, that's for sure.
It is. So, grasshoppers, oh my, what are you predicting now for those guys?
So in terms of prediction, USDA scientists and Scott Schnell with the University of Wyoming, there's a wonderful YouTube video that was produced out of Pueblo County. I want to link folks to that. There was a great statewide workshop that went on about grasshoppers I was involved with, and there is wonderful information on their prediction models that USDA creates. They base this off of density per square foot of adult flying grasshoppers, and there are maps that Coloradoans can access of USDA's predictions of grasshoppers, and there are certain counties that had alarming numbers per square foot in grasshoppers. Route County, I think there was even the Pueblo County area that kind of showed in those hot colors on these maps. In terms of egg laying, then likely there was lots of eggs laid. That's another big advantage grasshoppers have, is that they not only are they arid species, they thrive in arid climates, but they lay egg pods that can have, in 1 square foot, you can have 10,000 grasshopper eggs on the high end. So it doesn't get quite worse than that. But in addition, grasshoppers, they're hard to predict. A lot of it comes down to weather events and the lack of certain weather events, for example, like a spring freeze or a precipitation event, and then a drop in temperature, where grasshoppers that are emerging in millions across the landscape. I mean, this is an area-wide issue, folks. It's not just our backyards. This is landscapes across the American Southwest are experiencing multi-species level emergences of grasshoppers. And I got so many calls this year trying to explain to folks that this is not a problem that you can stop at the end of your property. I mean, it really is. It's the area, it's the region of the United States that is seeing increased incidence of these drought-loving pests. And it's driven often by a lack of a spring freeze. So if you have millions of hoppers emerging across the landscape and then it rains, and then the temperature plummets 60 degrees and gets a cold freeze, they all kick the can, and you don't have a grasshopper problem, at least with that particular species that year. So we unfortunately, in several counties and in pockets of Colorado, and it was larger than normal. It was noticed along the urban Front Range more. I mean, I had beekeepers associations in Pueblo County impacting their extension agent. I mean, I just couldn't believe that there were no flowering forbs available, but grasshoppers had just destroyed certain areas of the landscape, and bees couldn't forage for nectar, because those wildflowers out in the wild were being eaten to the ground by massive levels of grasshoppers. So it can have really interesting impacts when we have species emerge like this. Obviously, for the farmer, for the hay producer, anyone that keeps any livestock, it's very concerning. Recently spoke about grasshoppers in a neighboring county, and I was able to actually even convince a few folks that if you look at ecology, I mean, things like birds and fish and all of these other animals are having a food source. When we have these types of massive population booms and busts of insects, they're either there to eat or they're not. And so other animals do thrive and survive on big levels of grasshoppers. If you consider yourself an ecologist and someone that loves wildlife, I mean, grasshoppers across the state in the way that we saw it did a tremendous favor for many species. I mean, the sage grouse feeds its babies grasshopper nymphs. So, I mean, there's even endangered species that are benefiting from this. That's my one pitch, that they're not all bad, but it's not good for the Coloradoan or anyone with livelihood around growing plants when we have this type of insect issue. Of course, that takes the spotlight, but
Right. Well, everything has its good and bad, right?
that's
And after all, we're all connected. And so, a swing one way is going to do this, and a swing the other way is going to do that. So, If we could have, like in March, that -5 temperature for a couple of days, well, we'd kill off a lot of them, and then we'd be hopefully better off after that, since we're
Less to
not.
fight would be good.
Yeah, but here we're getting 50s and 60s, and they're just happy as anything. So how do we begin to monitor for those? What kind of scouting methods do you think are the best for people?
So I think that getting a density of grasshoppers for your property becomes very important. And if you're at all interested in grasshoppers, I'll say again, please look at this statewide workshop video because we talk about scouting techniques. There is a University of Wyoming document that talks to general public about how to sweep net using an insect net. If I had one close, I have one across the room, I'd show you. But it's a tool used to collect for collecting adult insects that fly. Just like many folks may be able to picture someone with a butterfly net, but that's one version. I mean, there are big insect nets that are used to collect all kinds of insects out there. And finding a density for your area becomes really important because then you're able to look at the USDA predictive modeling and look at what you're seeing, and you can work with an extension entomologist. Folks are always able to reach out to me if they have questions about how to use a sweep net, but quick actions back and forth help knock insects into the bottom of that net, and then certain counts are done and little worksheet is kept, and then you're able to figure out for that property, are there a lot of grasshoppers? Do I need to be worried? I think often across the landscape, when you're walking your dog and you see the roadsides covered in very tiny grasshoppers and it feels like the ground's moving up, of course we know there's a problem, but in other instances, sometimes in a big field of pasture land, it's not always the most straightforward. So really getting out there earlier than you think is a big tip. That we have early spring species that can be damaging, but it's mainly these early summer to late summer species that are the most prolific. Grasshoppers have probably about 15 species in the American Southwest that are considered pests. When we have hundreds in the country, beautiful tropical grasshoppers you'll see. As a group, they're not really all that bad, but there's several that thrive in arid lands. And grasshoppers, they're named for eating grasses, so they're successful at eating those and garden plants and tree fruit. Folks are losing their beautiful peaches out here in my area of Colorado to cosmetic damage because the grasshoppers are eating that juicy peach right off the tree. So there's so many of them, it becomes, yeah, an unstoppable force, really.
Well, several years ago in one of my counties, my master gardener and I went to this rural site, and she was desperate. She was calling us and saying, "Help! I don't know what to do." And so when we got there was a ditch that had grass in it, but they had mowed it like down to the nub, and there was a row of pines. And the grasshoppers were feeding in the ditch and then went to the pines and were stripping the needles of her pine trees. And there was like no turning back. It's like, okay, you want to minimize it, give them something to feed on. So what are some of your integrated pest management strategies towards that?
I'd say really with grasshoppers, historically, it's been managed first with chemical control. I mean, you look at federal spray programs that allowed folks to establish the West, and that's not really how we approach with IPM. But insect growth regulators are a wonderful tool for grasshoppers. It's a chemical that's sprayed and it prevents them from developing into adulthood before they're winged if this product is applied using the RATS program where 50% of the acreage is sprayed in strips. Hoppers or Grasshoppers are hopping in and out of those sprayed strips, and then you can collapse a population that way. Folks use baits where they bait and kill grasshoppers. I've seen cultural controls work, but this year they failed in a lot of instances. We had folks losing plants because they had netted them and grasshoppers were eating through the nets. I mean, this was not statewide, but this was occurring on some incidents where I had a few calls last summer where I was like, wow, that's not the first time I've heard that this year. there is a serious issue for Colorado. But really, exclusion netting or row covers, especially in garden settings where you can go in and really physically exclude grasshoppers from interacting with those plants, especially as they establish, those are critical tools of IPM, using those cultural and physical control methods. I think your strategy, Linda, of planting more that can work. My father lost his entire market farm up in the North Fork Valley this year. He couldn't even go to the farmers market. So they had a cut flower program, they had a vegetable program that could not launch. I mean, perennial irises were eaten down to the ground. I mean, truly, grasshoppers have a roosting behavior. So part of their biology is just to sit and munch. It's like Super Bowl Sunday. And just everyone gathers on the plants, all these grasshoppers come in and they just strip the epidermal cells off these plants and just they destroy petals and other plant parts that we consider obviously delicious and desirable until they get to them. So
It's not my couch, guys. Get off my couch. It's
exactly.
not Super Bowl Sunday. Get out of here. Oh
Exactly.
my gosh. Oh, you know, several years ago, I saw this thing on Facebook, and I guess it was like in either Indiana or Illinois, and they were having a grasshopper problem, and this farmer got so disgusted that he put this thing on his tractor that as he went along, he electrified them in front and he went up and down his field. And I thought, how
I've
clever.
never heard of that example. I'll be looking into that. You bet your bottom dollar. That's awesome. That's a good memory.
Hey, it
Oh,
works, right? You
that
know?
would work. There's one approach. Yeah, it's folks have another example that's kind of in a similar vein, but not quite as unique and creative is the chicken moat. Whitney Cranshaw, I think, created this idea of
Oh, yes.
you create a moat with fencing around your vegetable garden, so a perimeter where you would release chickens. And so hoppers, as they fly in from another yard or within the relative area, they're landing in. There's going to be some percentage of them that land in a moat of chickens. It's like the snake pit for them. I mean, they're going to be ripped apart by a few chickens in a matter of moments. If you're able to exclude the chickens from your vegetable plants, because your chickens will eat those, then
Well,
there's ways to use poultry and backyard poultry to fight grasshoppers.
and then sooner or later they get sick of it. So they want to move on to something
They want to eat. So yeah, I'm full of grasshoppers. I'm
else.
gonna try to peck through at your lettuce next or your strawberries. And I
Yeah.
know there's food safety issues with certain poultry, especially in orchards and in certain food settings. Having chickens poop everywhere is not always ideal. But if you can set it up in a way where they're excluded, it can work well. It can lower the number anyway.
Well, when those chickens get fed up, just sell them and get different chickens. Rotating succession of chicken. I don't know. Anyway. Oh, so Japanese beetles, that's just as bad. But thank God, knock on wood, we don't have them here in
I'm happy to
eastern
hear that. Yep.
Colorado. What's the concern for growers?
So in our area where we grow the famous Palisade peaches and we have a famous stone fruit industry here, post-Civil War era folks put in trees in the Grand Valley out here in Grand Junction where I live. We're about 30 miles from the Utah border, and we have what we call the million-dollar winds that come through Tibet Canyon and feed warm air to all of these trees. And it allows in this high elevation area, this in the high desert of Colorado, that we grow perennial tree fruit. Orchards, his before Cytospora would last up to 30 plus years. They have, some historic trees here, and folks don't want one more problem to deal with. So fortunately, the Japanese beetle is a forever issue on the urban Front Range of Colorado. There was not really actionable plans put into place to stop that from spreading around once it arrived. I think folks actually, it's not, I'm not sure if this is proven, but I've always wondered if maybe they didn't react in time because they thought the winters would kill the Japanese beetles off. And that unfortunately was not the case. They're living in these urban areas where there's urban thermal energy coming and there's a lot of turf grass, one of their major plants that they interact with. We have golf courses, we have parks, we have front lawns and backyards where we have turf grass for our pets, our children. There's an argument for having less turf grass in the landscape. I completely agree with that. There are certain bills in place to limit turf grass. I mean, of course, the neighbor that has 5 football fields of turf doesn't need that in the high desert, but there's an advantage of turf. I'll advocate for the fact that your trees are watered often through that irrigation system of your lawn, and folks are stripping out lawns and then their trees are dying and they're scratching their heads and your trees are deprived of water. So, I mean, there's a balance of how much turf grass to have, but in urban areas, we have a lot of it. And that's really that's the central area that Japanese beetles are going to be thriving, because they lay their eggs on that moist soil, often in a grass system. So Kentucky bluegrass is really famous. And, you know, humans move invasive species around through trade and transportation. We are the best animal to do it. We're guilty there. And we have defeated the Japanese beetle out here in our area to protect this tree fruit industry before. It was in the early 2000s. There was a program that folks came together, a multi-agency team of folks. A master gardener in 2002 found a Japanese beetle in city of Palisade, and everyone shut down and got to work and got rid of the beetle within 5-year program. They were able to erase thousands of beetles from the environment, which is no easy feat. Stopping biology is really hard, but there's been a massive effort in the second time this beetle has arrived, which was in 2022, about 20 years to the date of when it was originally found in the valley. It came back over. So it's going to be a constant problem. We'll fight a continuous population of beetles coming into the valley through humans transporting them. I mean, through education, we hope to minimize some of that, but truly, the Japanese beetle is one of, I mean, Whitney Cranshaw, my past boss, direct quote, I think he said it's the number one insect that's the easiest thing to move around in a vehicle. I mean, we were always very careful to not move Japanese beetle when we were coming from one site to another. I don't believe it ever happened, but we were always cognizant, and that cognizance goes a long way with invasive species movement. So folks are scared it's going to move into agriculture here. It's currently in our urban area. Wow, that was hard to say. But in general, that's going to be where they thrive. But folks that have orchards that have grass strips in between their trees that get irrigated, technically the Japanese beetle could survive there, but I don't feel that's where it's going to thrive. I think it's going to be the urban area, and then it's going to cause a problem for our tree fruit growers and our wine grape growers here in the valley, if it's to move there. And luckily, it has not since its introduction in 2022. We've been monitoring the valley with the Department of Agriculture in Colorado and efforts through the Upper Grand Valley Pest Control District here, a Mesa County organization. So, Extension and several others are working to deploy traps so that we know where this beetle is located. Because there's so few in our valley, we're using traps as an indicator of their presence. At some point, if we have so many beetles, we're going to end up, unfortunately, probably moving them around with some of these traps. So we're just trying to figure out exactly where they're located currently, which has been a multi-agency effort.
So, what other controls can people use that you would suggest that would be effective?
So really, it depends on where you live in the state of Colorado. So in terms of if I'm a homeowner in the city of Denver and I put up a trap, it's just going to bring everyone's beetles right to my yard. And it's not thought of as a control to use a trap. It's just monitoring. I mean, on the East Coast where they have Japanese beetles galore, they fill up big canisters each day. They fill up multiple of them because there's so many thousands of beetles in the environment living on, you know, several dozen of their favorite plants. But you know, if I'm in Denver, there's been some studies showing that hand knocking beetles into soapy water. If you just have a few rose plants and you have daily beetles coming in, if you don't want to be spraying a Acelaprin or one of the very few pesticides that you can spray, insecticides, on a flowering plant, there's not many things we can spray on a flowering plant because there's bees visiting, and at the same time, there's a Japanese beetle that we want to kill on that plant. So there's quite a management conundrum there. But hand knocking beetles into soapy water was something that I did. A perfect example is in Littleton at a certain garden. There was crews deployed to knock beetles off, and they were able to get something like 10,000 beetles a day. I mean, that's a horrible number, but that's being removed from the environment, and that's through human means. So, actually, like physical removal of beetles is a smart especially on something like flowers, where it's really hard to spray that with a product. It's also costly to use these products as a last resort. Insecticides, no one wants to willy-nilly just go spray it because they feel like it. It costs money to spray pesticides, so it's looking at your inputs. But I'm working with folks on the East Coast right now to do a drawing of a biocontrol agent. It's called the Winsome Fly, and it's unfortunately just much more popular on the East Coast. And there's a wasp, the typha wasp, that's out there in the Southeast that is a biocontrol agent. But biocontrol agents really, they're not knocking back that population in a massive way. They're just slowly reducing it. So really, I'm not sure if folks exclude Japanese beetles using nets. It's not incredibly common if they do, but they're big enough beetles. If you have a small enough
Right.
mesh, they're going to be excluded from those plants. So you could always try to think of physical exclusion too.
Right. Or rip up your lawn and put something way more native.
Yes, you could transition the way that we're managing the land.
Yeah.
And I think it's a critical component of, I'm always okay with some turf, but I think we really, it's a high water demand crop, and there's better mixes to put in, and there's zero scaping. There's a lot of it's a lot of fun things to do. I mean, I think you could use that lawn space as a vegetable garden, even though Japanese beetles might still be in that.
Right.
There maybe is different management. You're not going to have a whole several acres of lawn that are full of grubs, like we're seeing on the urban Front Range. I mean, there's just uncontrollable numbers of beetles in these lawns. So,
Well, and they were never meant to be here
no.
in reality, so
Unfortunately
they're
not.
unleashed, there's nothing, oh well, nobody's
Yeah,
gonna
we
come.
can't take that back. And that's why when invasive species move into new areas, that's why the city of Grand Junction, mainly Mesa County, took a massive effort. There are leaders in taking an eradication approach, saying, we don't want this to be an issue for our fruit growers. We're going to stop it in the urban area while it's here. Otherwise, it will be here for a long time. And multi-agency efforts like this are not easily achieved. I have to commend this group. It's been challenging, but this year, after the second year of sprays, the population last season, we had almost 6,000 beetles, and there was only 800 trapped in the 2024 season. So from 23 to 24, we were able to reduce the population by 86%. That just goes to show. I mean, that's not all of them, but that's a big portion of that population that was establishing that's been slowed down. That's maybe the best way to look at it. I mean, eradication is going to be a challenging thing to
Right.
achieve, but I think we're on a good path for giving it our best shot out here in Western Colorado, so it doesn't spread to neighboring counties. And hopefully eventually, if we can prove that this population has dwindled to other Department of Agriculture's, folks will be able to move plant material into other states, because that's one big issue, is there's all these extra interstate agreements that have to be met. If you're going to move plant material to another area, let's say you sell trees here in Mesa County, certain states may not want those trees anymore because you're within some distance of a Japanese beetle reproducing population. And then that makes your livelihood suffer because you can't move plant material into a new state or into a new county for that matter. Everyone on the urban Front Range it's the interstate quarantine. So if you live in some of those counties that have Japanese beetle confirmed, moving plant material to my side of the state, for example, you have to jump through a lot more hoops, and it's more expensive to move that plant material. And to have knowledgeable people in places, it's critically important when we're moving plants around. I mean, that's how emerald ash borer ended up in Boulder. It's how it ended up in now Carbondale last year. It hopped the divide. I mean, it's because humans are driving the movement of that
Yeah.
biology.
Yeah. Well, Nebraska, there's Nebraska nurseries that cannot ship plants into Colorado for that very reason. And yes, it's more expensive. And if we, as a number of states, would get together and all collaborate, I mean, yeah, it would take millions of dollars over several years, but boy, we could actually make a huge difference, right?
It's so challenging, and especially without federal funding, but
Mm-hmm.
it's that's really the biggest kicker there is Colorado gets left out of a lot of federal funds to fight invasive species. If you think about a state like California or Florida, that they fight so many more of those pests on the daily coming in through these port states, is how you should think about it. That's where we have the biggest incidence of, foreign species moving into our con onto our into our country. And so it's fortunately that's where a lot of the money goes, and then money dries up, and then by the time these species move mid-country, we end up having little federal dollars. This is not the first example of, federal dollars just going away. It used to exist in Colorado, and now there's no federal money to fight this pest. So it's left to the states to do something about it. And I think collaborating on a multi-state project, it would be possible, but it's just there's so much available habitat for these things and the perfect environment that it's a hard thing to stop. I think people should always be solution based though, and always be thinking of what can be done to stop evil pests. But the
Well,
Japanese beetle is it's a bad one. There's a lot of fear around it, and it's spreading to new areas because it does affect people's livelihood on some level. It can be impactful on the regulation side for sure. So,
suppression is probably the best effort at
yes.
this time. Same thing with invasive plants.
And
Suppression. We
there's good products that are being used to suppress Japanese beetles locally. We're targeting it's a Group 28 product. It's called chlorantraniliprole is the active. It's quite a mouthful, but it's a newer product. It's really safe, and it's what the county has used locally to apply to front and backyards and to parks, and churches are applying it. The city's applying it to their parks, and unincorporated Mesa County is applying it to all areas that the beetle could possibly thrive, just to try to suppress those numbers so that one beetle can go and lay, dozens and dozens of eggs, and then it can fly 3+ miles across valley and land. So I mean, we're tracking it so that we know where it is, and we're working with Mesa County to do so. Lots of agencies, Colorado Department of Ag and CSU Extension, they're working together to try to slow this roll, if not completely eliminate the population. That's the goal of the county, is eradication. And
Right.
we hope that they're successful and are doing what we can to help them in that effort.
Sure thing. Sure thing. Well, besides that, the corn earworm. Oh, yes. Okay. Major pest for sweet corn and other crops. So, what makes this pest so hard to control?
So it's a great question, and it's because this pest is a worldwide pest, and it's Helicoverpa zea is the scientific name of the corn earworm. But in the world of insects, we have a formal committee of people that name things, and they only give each insect one name. This insect has three official names because in corn, it's the corn earworm, Helicoverpa zea, same animal as the tomato fruit worm, Helicoverpa zea. In tomatoes, it's a significant pest. And in cotton, it's the cotton bollworm, Helicoverpa zea. So that animal has three names, and it's because of its relevance, economic relevance more than anything, in those agricultural systems. And earlier this year, I compared the corn earworm to the three-headed dog Cerberus that guards the gates of hell, because it has three common names, and it's for a reason that it has those names. Because if you're a tomato grower or a cotton grower or a corn grower, you know about Helicoverpa zea, and this is a worldwide pest that, unfortunately, through efforts made over the last several years on behalf of CSU Extension and a private crop consultant, moths have been sent to geneticists that were occurring locally because there was changed behavior. New things were occurring in our agricultural systems in corn out in western Colorado, and it sparked a lot of concern. And so we approached some pretty high-level scientists to look at the genome of this thing, and it has new genetics from its from a cousin, Helicoverpa armigera or armigera. And this is the pest that lives in throughout Asia, and it's what, like, for example, China's agricultural community spends the most money on controlling. It lives at higher elevations, it's more cold tolerant, it's very genetically similar to the corn earworm that we have locally, and now it shares genetics with this thing. They've created hybrids, and so unfortunately, how much hybridization has occurred is still being worked out by the geneticists. But here in Olathe, Colorado, unfortunately, it was one of the biggest examples in the most recent growing seasons that shows just not complete crop failure, because this pest doesn't kill corn, doesn't delete corn plants from the environment. What it does is it feeds on the developing corn and it ruins some portion of it and makes it unsellable. It's a cosmetic thing. And in certain areas of the country, it is a food safety thing because there's all kinds of molds and thing that grow when it's been chewed up. So it ruins the corn and makes it unsellable at a certain grade to a distributor. So folks are growing corn and are not able to sell it out here because there's some certain percentage of infestation from these caterpillars. So these caterpillars get into the corn. And unfortunately, we think not only they likely overwinter here, I think their ability to overwinter might be increasing with these new genetics, but that's too bold to say. We don't know how it's changed their behaviors yet. We just know that most of the population of corn earworm blows in from the south to the north. I mean, really, winds move it into the Uncompahgre Valley here. And so as soon as that crop is planted, there are winds that move that pest in, and then they start laying eggs in these on these developing corn plants. And boy, it's a hard thing to stop. I mean, corn has to be sprayed quite frequently to try to prevent that. And even then, we're having some issues with some of our chemistry. We're not sure if it's an IPM failure and we're not covering corn in the way we need to, or if the chemistry isn't really working the same way. We're doing some of that work with the Mickey Eubanks's lab in agricultural biology, he's an insect ecologist I'm going to be doing my PhD with. Some of this work will go into that, but it's a tough pest. And when something has new genetics, and there's some new reproduced version of it, it's often for a reason. And so unfortunately, those reasons might be because maybe this pests can overwinter more here in Colorado now. Maybe it's going to lay eggs differently on corn plants and make it harder to locate exactly where they are. I mean, it just changes the behavior. I think they could be more cold tolerant. I mean, a lot of this research has not been done yet, so we're not sure how it's impacting its ability to survive and to be a stronger pest, unfortunately. So there's a lot more work to do around. The lab I work with is going to start working with USDA scientists to work on this. This is becoming a national conversation. So we were able to find an issue here in Olathe, Colorado, that's now started national, if not international level conversations about how similar pests are breeding. And unfortunately, it's the presence of these new alleles that are, I think, we'll likely find that they're changing behavior of this moth. We're not there yet, but I have a feeling that's where it's going. So it's a top worldwide pest that we're going to struggle to stop now, I think.
Well, explain to people what alleles are.
Alleles. Yeah, so there are certain genes essentially that are flowing into a population. So when something gets new genes, there's some advantage of having those new genes, and it may cause something to look different, maybe a phenotypic difference, or maybe it behaves differently because of its genetics. Its, genotype has changed. So unfortunately, it's not good when two worldwide pests decide to intermix their genomes, and I think it's definitely going to lead to a lot of new, interesting research for this country. Not necessarily good for sweet corn.
Well, they adapt, and then when they genetically cross or breed, that the strongest characteristic can come out, the dominant versus non-dominant, and that's just like oh, I don't know, it's like playing bingo. You just shake it all up, and then.
It definitely is, like, it's causing folks to ask questions. And I know our PPQ unit in Fort Collins, USDA genomics specialists are looking at this, at these moths as our collaborators, and starting to learn more and more. But there's a tremendous amount of research to do in this space. Frankly, we're still learning, and will be for a long time, on how we can combat something like a new pest like this. But I truly believe it's likely linked to the new genetics that we're having, the issues that we're having in corn. That's not yet been proven. It's bold for me to even say that, but for a long time our systems were working, And then certain changes with either IPM or with these new genetics are going to lead to new unfortunate outcomes for folks packing corn out of the, Uncompahgre Valley. It's been an intensified agricultural system like this exists because people need perfect food. And that's even bold for me to say, but we pay a lot for our food in the grocery stores. We have grocery stores for a reason, and I'll try to stop myself when I go to, oh, is that a perfect orange or is it soft? Or, we really are just lucky to have food in front of us, and farmers are incredibly strained trying to create perfect food. And I think they need some consumers to have a little bit more of a less skeptical eye or a little bit more of an understanding, maybe. I think culture like that is slowest to change, especially with how much we pay for things. But this is an important conversation to be having about, if there's a little bit of corn earworm in a shipment, distributors don't want to buy it. And it's because consumers don't want to buy it. So if consumers are more accepting of produce, I think that could help a lot in relieving some of these issues we see across all cropping systems, not just in sweet corn. We're
Well,
quite picky eaters.
those of us who garden, we'll deal with a blemish, right? So
You cut it out. We used to cut the worm out of the apple and out of the corn. And that's how we took care of the coddling moth and the corn earworm.
I
So,
mean, it's still good for the
a
most
lot of good
part,
food going to
but
waste.
and yeah, we grew it. We're not going to throw it away. And I don't know. I guess it is perfect that way. That's just all encompassing. This is the way it is. And yeah, like the perfect lawn or the perfect, yeah, no, don't get me started. Please don't get me started. Oh, so how can farmers stay up with the best management recommendations? I guess that's going to be as your research comes out and goes forward and you learn more, because I'll tell you, animals, insects are particularly adaptive. They're gonna want to come out on top and survive, and they can. And it's the same way with plants. It just takes, sometimes it takes plants longer, but there you are.
I think that in terms of updates from our program in Western Colorado, we post everything to our Western Colorado insect page that we're currently working on. And you can always follow publications of ours, like through Google Scholar. You can type my name in and see if we've published anything new in this space. It'll likely be over the next probably 5 years that more publications come out. Five is maybe a little bit more than I'd like it to be. Maybe next several years, hopefully, we'll be able to actually start to formulate more of an idea of what's happening on corn earworm, or especially on Japanese beetle. I think that there'll be some papers that come out around the efforts that have been made in Western Colorado, especially since it's been somewhat of a success so far. Removing biology is really hard. So whenever you're able to reduce a population by 86%, I mean, there's definitely something that's going right. So I think that work needs to be highlighted. So certain journal articles will be written and then posted to our web page. So folks are always able to reach out directly to me too. I work hard to work out of area. I have to work on my four counties as a priority, but folks across the state of Colorado reach out to me regularly, and it really helps build me as a professional and as an entomologist. It helps me learn what's happening in Colorado. So if there's ever burning questions, of course, reach out to your local extension agents first, and if not, they can connect you with me if you have a question about any of the pests we talked about today or any other insects that you see in the garden or out there in the wild world.
Good information. Good. So Tri River area website would be the one that people would go on. Okay.
Yeah, and we
Okay.
have one called, it's like, I could try to get the URL. I don't know if I'll remember it, so I don't want to,
Well,
for the
you
recording's
can.
sake, but I could get it to you and so that
Yes.
you can send it out. It's
Yes.
Western Colorado Insect Extension Page is really how I would Google search that, but I can get you the URL, Linda.
Please do, and we'll put it on to the podcast in the description
Awesome.
of the podcast. So send me those links that you talked about, and that way it can be available to people
Perfect.
everywhere. So la one last piece of advice for everybody. How do we manage these pests effectively? I mean, across the board.
I think in general, The biggest issues I see, I think, can be prevented on some level, at least in the garden setting, by just having someone be a really good observer. Like, I think folks need to work on their observation skills and their just taking the time and respecting the time for walking your land and walking your garden and being an investigative, scientist, if you will. Look out at what you have on your landscape and try ahead of time to think through, okay, well, when this plant is four times this size, what problems am I going to have, and what tools am I going to need to have on deck so that I'm ready to fight these things? Thinking as much ahead as you can, documenting things, keeping regular schedules of things, when you're ordering your seeds this time of year versus when you're going to be planting them, and then fighting thrips in several months on your tomatoes, and when you get new plant material, are you going to quarantine that before you introduce a pest to your whole greenhouse? I mean, just thinking ahead a lot of the time. I mean, taking a moment to just be still and really trying to play that game of chess goes a long way, I think, across all these systems. That can help a lot by being prepared. Proper prior planning is
Right.
important.
Well, and are you going to set up any citizen science stuff for people in your area so they can be trained and educated and participate in the process?
So we've done that the last 3 years, and we're switching to my full-time research associate this year just for data equity. I'm having issues with volunteer reporting, unfortunately, so we're switching away from that model. But it's been a great one, Linda, so far. Citizen scientists have helped to give data to our area, but just to have better and more reliable data, I should say, not better, but more reliable data. Someone that's gonna, I know, is gonna check that trap every 2 weeks. I
Right.
was giving these out to citizens and training them, and then I would get one report when I needed 12 or something. So, not across the board or anything. I'd say about 50% of folks participated, which
Right.
is reasonable, but we're gonna switch so that we can have 100% reliable data this year. So we'll have one individual kind of running that program who's been trapping insects in the Grand Valley for 25 years. She's worked for three different extension entomologists, Melissa Franklin. She's the brains of the operation here, I have to say. So
Cool. That's great. That's great. Well, Melissa, thank you. You've been a wonderful resource of knowledge, and we'll have you on again.
awesome. Love to be back. Thanks for having me, Linda, always, and for the opportunity to share about something I'm so passionate about. And I think folks should, the insects are often understudied, underestimated, and misunderstood. And I think that there's a lot of it's kind of a disservice we're doing to a big group of animals by having this, we're afraid of them, or we are disgusted by them. I mean, there's a tremendous amount to learn from insects. So anytime I have the opportunity to share, I'm happy to do so. So thanks.
Yay. Well, fingers crossed on your research.
Yes, thank you.
And please keep me posted, and we'll have you back on. And thank you, Melissa, for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you to the audience for listening. Tune in next time when we get to the heart of the matter of another horticultural topic.